Welcome to the Stage Left podcast with Richard Fortus of Guns N' Roses. We'll just begin by saying for more episodes featuring Michael Jackson guitarist and She Rocks award winner Jennifer Batten, Grammy Hall of Fame inductee Steve Cropper, legendary producer Tony Visconti on the recording process of David Bowie's final album Black Star, Sum 41 bassist Cone McCaslin on working with Iggy Pop, and guitarist Billy Burnett on touring with Bob Dylan, and for a decade in Fleetwood Mac. Go to the stageleftpodcast.com, follow us on Twitter at the Stage Left Pod, like us on Facebook at facebook.com/thestageleftpodcast, and subscribe on iTunes and Spotify, write reviews and check our Instagram for behind the scenes material. Upcoming episodes include Wolfgang Fleur, an original member of Kraftwerk, to stay in the loop by following us on Facebook, etc. We ourselves are musicians and recently released a self-titled album called Last Wilderness, which features previous Stage Left guests. So Elvis Presley's pianist Shane Keister and Paul McCartney's guitarist from Wings Lawrence Juber guested on that album. So visit lastwilderness.bandcamp.com to check that out. Since our last episode with George Vajestakov, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, we were podcast of the week in We Are Cult Online. Be careful when you say that. Please read that interview on our Twitter page. That was a great privilege to be podcast of the week. And we are confirmed to be attending Glastonbury Festival in June. So if you're there, come and say hi. And we're going to try and put together an episode from the festival, providing I don't get all my equipment too muddy. So here is episode 31, the compelling, honest and downright funny Richard Fortus of Guns N' Roses. To the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. And what a vantage point we have on today's episode, as we're joined by a man who's been a member of the truly legendary Guns N' Roses for 16 years, travelling to every corner of the globe to play colossal concerts with one of the most iconic bands of the past 30 years, and has not only played on, but has a songwriting credit on the most expensive album ever recorded, Chinese Democracy. Our guest today has played on innumerable other significant projects, including the Dead Daisies, who were one of the first bands to play in Cuba after the trade embargo was lifted, and is highly regarded across a plethora of genres, which has led to collaborations with Puff Daddy, Rihanna, Thin Lizzy, and our guest today was the go-to guitarist when the hip-hop scene took off in New York City. Today we'll be finding out who the man is behind the guitar, and how he goes about working with Slash on complementing guitar effects to create the best sound for the band. We'll get advice for those on the periphery of the music industry trying to break through, and we'll be finding out what Axl Rose's brilliant response was when our guest today informed Axl he couldn't join Guns N' Roses as he had to instead fulfil touring duties with none other than Enrique Iglesias. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today is none other than Richard Fortus of Guns N' Roses. So thanks for joining us today, Richard. How's it going?
My pleasure. It's going well.
Good, good, good. Thank you. So you've just got back from playing gigs, I believe, in Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, Thailand and Dubai. Quite different cultures and landscapes.
Japan.
And Japan as well. There we go. Fantastic. Yeah. So you must get a very unique snapshot as you tour different cultures and different landscapes, dipping from one country, playing to 60,000 people and then packing up and moving on to another one. What challenges does that give you as a touring artist, and how do audiences differ from country to country?
Well, I'm just on this tour, on this leg. I think the difference between, you know, Japan has a very unique audience, and that their response generally is very, very polite and well-mannered. They're very proper, and they sit and they are very attentive and very focused, and they listen to the band, and then when the band is done with the song, then they'll clap. There's no clapping or singing along or anything like that during the song. They're silent and they're focused and sitting down, and then afterwards they'll clap. But it's very different than it was something like juxtaposed to South America, where it's just bedlam. I mean, that they're singing the guitar solos. They're, you know, it's crazy. Very, very different. Australia's audiences are very good in that sort of Australian pub type way. You know, they're pretty rowdy and like to have a good time and are passionate about the music. And then where else did we get? From Australia and New Zealand, we went to Singapore, which was there's a lot of expats there. You know, it's really become, God, Singapore's completely changed from the last time I've been there, which had been, you know, a good, God, I don't think I've been in Singapore for like 16 years, and completely different. But yeah, it's just that's a very varied audience. You know, there's people from all over the world, and same with Dubai. So yeah, I mean, that's on this tour alone, it's, you know, those audiences differed quite a bit.
Yeah, it sounds incredible. And do you get an opportunity to see much of the different cultures and countries while you're there, or you kind of?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I always get out and see as much as I can. We're always looking for, you know, interesting things to do. But, you know, a lot of these places, I don't think there's no place I hadn't been already on this tour. But I still try and get out. You know, it's Thailand's, playing Thailand was the first time I've actually played in Thailand. And Thailand's probably my favorite place in the world. So it was great to finally be able to play there, because I used to go there quite a bit. I used to go every year, and just on holiday. So it was really nice to play there and have all my friends come out.
And you obviously play some enormous, colossal gigs with Guns N' Roses, and obviously you play other gigs with all your other projects as well. And the stadium shows playing to, you know, 60,000 to 70,000 people, sometimes even more than that. How do you compare them from to the smaller shows, the kind of smaller, sweatier kind of club shows that I know you still play? From a sound point of view on stage, is there anything particular that you miss from doing one compared to the other?
It's a very different experience. Playing face to face with people is obviously going to be much different than standing on a huge stage where you can barely see people's faces, you know. The great thing about being on our own stage that we travel with and that we build every time, and it's consistent, you know, is that just that it's consistent. It's like a second home. You know where you are at all moments. You know, there's no surprises. It's the sound is always the same, because we use, you know, it's all in-ear monitors, and so it's very consistent, and that's nice.
It's a recent theme It's a recent theme on the Stage Left podcast, talking to musicians who use in-ear monitors, because most of the musicians who we have a lot of musicians listen to the show, and not all of them get the privilege or the opportunity to use in-ear monitors. What are the advantages and disadvantages from your point of view, having used both?
Okay. You know, I've been using in-ear monitors since I was with the Psychedelic Furs, and that's, you know, for the last 20 years. So when I don't use them, I guess with the Daisies, for most of it, I didn't use in-ears. And also with Thin Lizzy, touring with Thin Lizzy, I didn't use in-ears. And boy, it was really refreshing to not use them, because you have much more of a, it's a lot less clinical and under a microscope than when you have in-ears in. That being said, the advantage to in-ears is that you play like you're under a microscope. You know, you really pay attention to the subtleties and nuances and the details.
Do you miss an opportunity to communicate with the band in some way by having in-ears, or is it?
You know, it's a little bit of a hassle. On stage, it's not that big of a deal. We've got talkback mics set up around the stage, so all you do is you walk up to the microphone and you step on a button, and it isolates, so only the band can hear it.
Wow.
Which, you know, in the hands of Axel can be pretty difficult because he just tells jokes while we're playing, which can be pretty distracting if you're, you know, playing a solo or something and he's telling a joke. So that's a bit of a challenge, but you know, and that's generally what we're communicating about. We're actually usually telling jokes
that's
to each other.
Quote from you here, you said about playing gigs, you said, yeah, I'm always nervous. I mean, before I go on stage, I'm nervous. I've been doing it for so long, for my whole life, but I feel more at home on stage than I do off stage. Why is that? I mean, who do you become on stage that you aren't off stage?
There's a sense of being in control that comes on stage, you know, with being on stage for me. And I don't know that that's something I experience all the time off stage, and it feels very comfortable. You know, there's it's really difficult to put it into words, the feeling when you walk out on stage and you're flanked by your friends, and it just, I don't know, it's an incredible feeling.
Another quote from you that I really liked, and I'd like you to elaborate on if possible, was you can rehearse and rehearse forever, but it's a different set of muscles that you use on stage. Can you elaborate on that?
It's... you're never going to, no matter how much you rehearse a song, you're never going to be prepared for stepping on stage. The only thing that prepares you for stepping on stage and playing a great show is playing a bunch of shows. To get that, it's just, it's a different set of muscles. And actually I might have said that, but that's actually a Tommy Stinson quote.
Ah, all right, okay.
But I know I have said that before because it's absolutely true, but I don't want to take credit away from
that. Okay. So going back to your early life, you grew up in, St. Louis, is that right?
That's right.
And you're there now, I believe.
I'm home for 2 months.
Oh, exciting. I know when we exchanged emails, I could tell the excitement of being home again. And, I mean, touring, obviously, with Guns N' Roses must be amazing and a unique experience. After doing it for so long with so many different bands, how do you approach the mindset of touring now compared to when you were 20?
Well, I think what's ultimately more important to me, and the biggest change for me in my life, is that of having children. Because when I was single and didn't have kids, that I couldn't wait to be back on the road. You know, it was really that was when I really felt I was living life, you know, and the rest of the time was sort of waiting around to tour again. Even though I was always very busy in the studio and whatnot, but and I love that, but it was just a really I don't know. There's obviously so many spoils that go with touring, and you know that I was enjoying quite a bit at that time. And now it's just it's completely different. Now it's, you know, I love doing it, but it's just very different for me.
Paint a picture of what it is like touring with Guns N' Roses in kind of 2017. Do you all travel together, or is it all separate?
Yeah, we all travel together. And yeah, I guess for me, we're always looking for things to do. You know, I think it's harder. It's hardest for Slash and Duff. Sorry, Slash and Axel, to go out and enjoy a city.
Mm.
You know,
they get recognized, right? Everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, Slash always looks like Slash. You know, Duff can throw a baseball cap on, and personality-wise, he just has a great way of assimilating and not sticking out. Whereas I think it's harder for Slash, because Slash is just such an iconic image, you know?
Yeah.
And the same with Axel. And for different reasons, I don't know, it's it would be tough, I think, to have that and to not be able to go out and really enjoy a city. But I'm generally Duff and I will hang out, we'll go out and look for stuff to see and do. You're always looking for ways to occupy your time and to get to know a city. I run every day, so for me that's a great way to get to see things that you normally don't get to see.
I wouldn't recommend going running in Bangkok with that humidity. That would be
you know, it's not the humidity. Bangkok's really difficult because there's no sidewalks.
Right.
You know, it's a difficult place to walk, let alone run. Yeah, yeah. You know? Yeah, it's pretty impossible to run there. But every place else on this tour was great.
Sounds amazing.
Singapore was great running. You know, Australia's awesome.
Sounds amazing. So you're back home in St. Louis now, and I believe growing up, your father owned a record store. Is that right?
No. He was partners in a company that made musical instruments.
Oh, right. Okay.
So they made guitars and they made amplifiers, and that's how I was exposed to music at a young age.
Was your dad a guitarist?
He wasn't. He didn't. He was an accountant.
Oh, right.
Had nothing to do with music other than he worked in that business. But I was around a lot of people that were musicians that worked for him.
Right.
And that really is what influenced me and got me. But I think my love of music goes back even before then.
So you got an autograph at the age of 8 years old from, is it Paul Stanley from Kiss? Is that right?
Wow, where'd you hear that?
It's a picture that says, "Too rich, you keep practicing, and someday maybe you'll be playing with us." Is that something like that?
That's right. That's right. Did I post that on Facebook?
I can't remember where I found that research from. But,
okay, yeah. I actually came across that photo not long ago.
Have you still got it? You got it still?
Yeah.
Oh, amazing. And so
yeah, it's like an 8x10.
And so was that a big moment for you, or was it even before then you were into music?
Yeah. When I was young, I started on violin when I was about 4, and really became obsessed with rock and roll about 7 or 8. And
tell us about your aunt. So is it right your aunt found Jesus and decided to disown her record collection, and you kind of inherited this record collection through that process? Is that right?
That's right. I benefited from her being born again and finding Jesus and wanting to part ways with all of her secular records, which I embraced. Bands like the Beatles and, you know, all the classic Rolling Stones stuff, Humble Pie, Black Sabbath, and I inherited this great collection, and that really shaped my young musical mind.
It's funny how little things that happen can shape people's futures, you know. Maybe your future would have been end up the same, but that's a hell of a record collection to kind of just get landed.
Yeah,
on.
Yeah.
Another band you mentioned that you liked back in the day was The Damned, and we had Monty Oxymoron from The Damned on a previous episode, who was great fun. What did that band particularly mean to you?
You know, The Damned was not as big of an influence as bands like The Clash,
right,
or The Police, or you know, The Furs, U2, Echo and the Bunnymen.
Bunnymen, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Cool.
And then getting into bands like Black Flag and Red Cross, and you know, that was a big deal too. The Dead Kennedys. And
who was influencing you as a guitarist? Who were you trying to emulate? Who were you in your bedroom kind of pretending to be when you were kind of 13 or 14 years old with the guitar?
13 or 14 was before I was really into that stuff. It wasn't until I was about, 14, 15 is when I first heard The Clash, and that's
right.
That took me a different direction. But before then, it was classic rock, like, you know, I guess guitar players like Mick Taylor and Santana and John McLaughlin, Steve Howe, Robert Fripp. Big time. Fripp was definitely a huge influence on me.
Yeah, we had Visconti talking about working with Fripp on with Bowie a while ago. Amazing player. Another incident that I kind of picked up in my research. I don't know if this is true or not, but you bought your first guitar at the age of 12, and you were selling drugs. Is that right? At the age of 12, to be able to fund that. Is that real?
Yeah. Man, you dug deep. I bought it from, actually I got a good deal on it because it was a guitar that my father's company had.
You got a good deal. What about like the whole, how you got into that? I mean, you don't have to kind of detail how you got into that world, but like that's especially young age to be kind of in
yeah, but that's just where, I mean, that it was that time and where I grew up, you know, in the Midwest. It was at that time, it was a lot of bored kids, you know, looking for adventure.
Yeah. And I mean, and how did, so you kind of an early age looking into this kind of rock and roll lifestyle, if you like, in a cliche way. But so your father was an accountant. How did he feel about when your career started taking off and when you started really showing an interest in this world? Was there anybody saying no? Richard, we want you to be an accountant. You know, was there a difficulty there?
No, you know,
there?
He always said, it's great. It's a great hobby, you know, but you need something to fall back on. And
which was what?
But he never really pushed me. I, you know, when I got a scholarship to Southern Illinois University, and I started going when I was out of high school. But I just wanted to take music classes, and my band then was doing really well, and I didn't really have any interest in anything but music, and that was my focus. And you know, I guess also in business, but really it was music business stuff, and there was no real classes at that time for things like that. And so I, you know, after a few months, they wanted me to take academic classes, and I had no interest. And like I said, I mean, at that point my band was starting to take off, and there's a lot of record company interest, and so I just sort of went with that.
Incredible.
And it wasn't long after that we signed with Atlantic, and I started.
And your family were behind you. So when you started signing record contracts and stuff like that, your family were fully behind you doing that as a career at that stage?
You know, I had moved out at a young age and really sort of didn't pay any attention to what they said.
That's a good, you know, good attitude to have in some ways, because we have a lot of young musicians now, and it's like so much pressure from like, no, you've got to go and get a proper job and that kind of thing. And it's just really interesting to ask people like yourselves who took the kind of risk and took the plunge and has, you know, is playing the dream gigs now that young musicians would love to play, if they have ever had that pressure themselves.
Yeah. I, you know, it's a different time in music too. As far as, you know, God, man, that's a tough road at this point. You know, I guess it always was, and it seemed somewhat impossible or unobtainable back in the day when I was just starting. But, I mean, it was really, it was so grassroots at that time, where, you know, putting up flyers, and it wasn't about YouTube hits. It wasn't about your Facebook profile. It was, you know, really about just getting people to your shows and signing with a major label. And it's a very different story now.
Yeah, I think it's a subject we might touch upon later on, actually. One area you talk about being involved in a scene, I know you speak quite nostalgically about this in other interviews and not in too much detail, so I'd like to kind of focus on this, is you speak fondly about a time in New York when hip-hop really took off. And you worked
well, you know, hip-hop was taking off. I was into hip-hop when I was, you know, my later teens, I guess, in St. Louis, and it was around a lot, you know, even in high school. It was, hip-hop was a part of the musical landscape, and it was very, it was new and exciting, and, you know, I went to school with, half the kids at my school were black, half were white, and it was kept that way, for, as part of the, it was a magnet school, so it had to be, they had to keep it 50-50.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I was exposed to a lot of funk music, you know, Parliament and things like that, when I was in high school. And hip-hop, I always enjoyed, you know, from Sugar Hill. And then when Public Enemy's first album came out, I mean, that changed everything. Yo Bum vs. Show and the first N.W.A. album. You know, the Eazy-E stuff. All that was, it was a big part of my growing up as well. And then when I got to New York, I don't know how I got into that. I guess I was doing so many sessions that, you know, it was inevitable that if a hip hop artist was working with a producer and they needed a guitar player, I would get a call. And because I was sort of the go-to guy in New York, and I ended up doing a lot of that stuff, you know, working with everyone from the Wu-Tang guys to
really
Puffy stuff, and whenever somebody needed guitar in New York, good, and New York hip hop, I seemed to get calls.
That's an amazing reputation to have. Incredible. And what, I mean, you obviously worked with Puff Daddy and Wu-Tang, you mentioned there. Were there any new challenges in your playing, or can you think of a time where you were playing a different style of music or with a different type of band, and it really challenged you as a musician, or had you accomplished what you wanted to accomplish at a young age enough that you could then just adapt where you needed to?
Yeah, you know, there's always challenges. There's always challenges whenever you... I'll tell you some of the biggest challenges. Going to Nashville, like getting a call in New York and asking me to come to Nashville and doing sessions in Nashville, which I didn't do much of, but, you know, I did a few times where I would go to Nashville and do sessions, do albums. And because I think producers wanted something different, I guess, you know, and I would get calls and go out there, and that was very challenging and very stressful and very different than the system in New York. You know, when you're in Nashville, it's a totally different vibe. You know, it's a factory. They're just churning things out. It's incredible. And the level of musicianship is just unreal. And you go into a session there, and the producer will put a demo cassette on, and you listen to it. You know, there was like, this is back when cassettes were, you know, the medium of demos. And we would listen, we'd all sit around and listen to the demo. And then I'll never forget this. The first time it happened to me, I was in the control room with all these great players. We're listening through, and And they listen through the song once and they go, okay, let's go ahead and let's go do it. And nobody had been writing anything down. They just went out in the studio and played it back.
Wow.
Which I found incredible. You know, people were making notes, you know, but nobody had an instrument. And they just went out and did it. It's incredible to me. I mean, that's so different to how the recording process went in New York, where I was generally called in after the bass, drums, and keyboards were down and a scratch vocal. And then I would come in and play on top of it. And, you know, you experiment. You sit there and you try different amps. You try different pedals. You know, different guitars until you find what is going to work best for the track. And this is, you know, in Nashville, you have your sound. You have your clean sound. You have your rock sound. And that was it.
You've also done some stuff, I believe, around doing film scores. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, film scores. That's a really interesting area. Tell us give us an insight to, you know, let's say someone's a really, really good musician, accomplished musician, and then has to sit down and write a film score for the first time or a piece of music. What are the new challenges that kind of really leave you scratching your head when approaching that?
Well, I mean, working the picture is a completely different animal. I got into it because a lot of the sessions that I was doing in New York, probably most of them, were either for TV or TV commercials, or for movies. That's generally what I was doing. So I then started a company. I was getting asked to compose for different, if I'd be interested in composing for different jingle houses or TV, you know, so doing TV themes or something like that. And you demo on them, and then, you know, as you become more advanced, you win a few and it sort of takes off. And that's what I did, and I started my own company, and we had a studio. I had a partner that I worked with, and then we had a few people, you know, it just grew and grew. I had a few people working for me, kids that were working in different studios in our main studio, and it just sort of grew. And through that, started doing more film stuff. It is a very, you know, when you're working with commercials, it's a very different thing, because it's a small, you're dealing with such a finite time frame. You know, you've got 30 seconds or a minute at most. And same with TV themes. But then when you start scoring shows, you've got more room. And then when you do movies, it's a totally different thing. But that's how I got into it, was through advertising.
For things like that, do you often get the blueprint in advance or the images in advance and you write over it, or is it stuff that
Sure.
you've got kind of library?
Yeah, you're scoring to picture.
Right.
So they're not, generally, they're not cutting to your music.
Yeah. It's interesting because Quentin Tarantino did an interview with a guy called Jonathan Ross, who's well known in the UK. And He said that Jonathan Ross challenged him as to why he never gets someone to compose a score on his films. And he said Tarantino kind of backed off and backed off and backed off, and eventually said, it's because I don't want anyone to have more power than I do over my film. Was there ever any examples where you kind of completely pitched it wrong and stuff was maybe misinterpreted, or music kind of made images be interpreted in a different way than what the director was thinking?
You know, there's always times when you're going to go back and forth. I mean, that happens all the time. But getting it completely right, yeah, I guess so. I guess so. But, you know, you sort of work in stages. You do a mock-up of something and say, this is the type of direction that I'm thinking. And occasionally it's like, well, that's really not the feeling I had. I was looking for something. But generally, before you start out, there's a discussion, you know, and it might be over coffee, or it might be a director sending you placement music, you know, with music that he had in his head, the type of thing. And then you're basically going in and doing something with a similar feel, or trying to capture that feel, because a lot of times that's generally how it is. And then other times you'll speak through it, you know, you'll talk through it, and you'll say, you know, this is what I'm hearing for the general theme or for this character's theme. And then they'll say, well, you know, that sounds great. Or they'll say, you know, I was thinking about this. And you sort of work through it that way. And that happens, you know, even when you're doing sessions. You know, it's about communication. It's about, and I think that's why some people work a lot and some people don't, because it's about communicating. And if a producer can, on a session, can say to you, this is the type of sound I'm looking for. I'm looking for, you know, I'm thinking like Tommy Bolin meets, I don't know, you know what I mean? Like, I'm thinking this type of sound. Like, I'm thinking Live at Leeds meets Wind and Weathering, or, you know, whatever references they're going to throw at you. And you know what they're talking about and know how to achieve that.
Yeah.
You know, that's a big thing. And that's why I think I've been able to work. I have that language, that reference point.
Interestingly, you talked about when you worked with Rihanna, you said that one of the challenges was actually kind of, she had so much kind of sonic ground to cover because she had so many different effects on the original recordings, that kind of thing. How does someone go about that? Let's say if you were to give advice to a young musician who perhaps doesn't have much of a budget. So, you know, I'm guessing in a situation with Rihanna, you're allowed to buy the pedals that you think are going to create the right sounds and that kind of thing. How does someone go about that? What advice would you give them? Because that must be really, really difficult with different artists.
In this day and age, to do a pop gig, I would almost always take either an Axe FX or a Kemper profiler, so that I could cover a lot more sonic territory, you know, than just taking a Marshall or just taking a twin with a bunch of pedals. And not only does it minimize your footprint as far as production and what's needed, you're going to be much more in control and much more able to cover everything you need to cover, and also be able to automate it so that it could run off of a master sequencer.
Mm-hmm.
So all your changes could be programmed and then you run by the sequencer or the master clock, because all those, you know, it's a totally different thing to what I do with GNR, where there's no track, there's no sequenced parts. You know, a lot of the pop, all the pop gigs are all playing to track.
So it's a slightly different world to GNR, but
completely different. You know, I couldn't use a, I wouldn't use a digital amp with GNR. I mean, it's very, you know, I wouldn't use it with Thin Lizzy. You know, there's no place for it because it's about the subtleties. You know, it's about working your volume knob on your guitar. You know, I have one. I don't use multi-channel amps on GNR.
Right.
I have a single channel amp and I work my volume control.
Wow. Okay.
And there's so many subtleties in that, you know, in working the volume, that Slash and I both do. And that's, you know, that goes away with a digital amp. But, you know, if you're with Muse or with Metallica, where there's dramatic shifts, that stuff works great. You know, Metallica switched to using all Kempers. And so does Muse. And so does so do a lot of other bands. Because it's consistent, you know, they can and controllable.
Talk us through, so you mentioned about working with Slash, you spoke about this in the past, so I find it quite interesting, how you work on making sure that what the two of you are doing really, really fits well sonically. How do you go about that, and is it something that is continuously ongoing, or once you've nailed Sweet Child of Mine, that's it, and you never touch it again?
No, it's constantly evolving. I mean, it's because you're always searching for something better, you know?
And is that led by Slash, or do you feel there's a responsibility for yourself to?
No, it's not. No, it's just.
So you don't feel you've got to recreate exactly what's on the record from a sound point of view, and that's it, or you?
No. It's. I don't think it's. If I was just trying to recreate simply what was on the record, it wouldn't be a constant search. You know, it would just be sticking to one thing and making it the same every night. I think I'm always, Slash is the same, and we're always trying to make things better. We're always trying to make it bigger and work better together and separate our tones, separate them, but somehow make them better for ourselves and more inspiring to play.
When you first joined the band, and this is obviously before Slash rejoined, how did you divide up the guitar parts? Because there's kind of times where you're playing guitar solos and someone else is playing on another occasion. How did you divide those up? Was that a particular process you went through, or?
You know, it all seemed to, everybody sort of had their role, I guess. And we would divide it up accordingly. And I don't know, it changed with every incarnation. But, you know, it was a difficult thing to divide up and who's going to cover what ground, you know, but I don't know, there was no rules. It went song by song.
You absolutely nailed the, I found a version of you absolutely nailing this solo in the middle of November Rain. It's from a show where Axel's on a piano that's floating over a crowd. I don't know if it was some.
Oh, right. Yeah, Slash took that away from me.
Oh, right. I was going to say, how did that conversation go down? How did that go down when that happened?
Well, actually, you know, when I started playing that first solo in November Rain, that was Robin was playing it, and Axel had asked in the middle of a tour. He said, "Hey, can I hear Richard play that?" And that's when I start playing it.
We need some time.
tell us about working with Slash. He's obviously a great guitarist, and he's got obviously this really laid back persona, if you like. Is that the case off stage and when he's addressing his work, or is he an intense character?
He's intense when it comes to music. He loves to play, and he wants it to be perfect. You know, and when I say perfect, he wants it. He wants the band to be at our best. And he will rest at nothing until he feels that we're doing our best, we're in our best place and able to put our best foot forward. He wants to be as well rehearsed as possible. Which I agree with that. When you step on stage, you don't have to, the chances of having to actually think about anything like that is gone. And then you're faced with all your other set of issues that occur playing a live show. But the music is second nature as possible.
Is that how you approach it as well?
No, he's much more thorough than I am. He loves to rehearse. He loves to spend. We spend a lot of time rehearsing with this band, more than we ever did before he was back in the band. And it's hard to fault anybody that wants it to be as good as possible, you know, and I'm all for that. And it definitely works. I mean, I think this band has never sounded better than it does right now.
Tell us about the audition, because you, I believe, were playing Royal Albert Hall with Enrique Iglesias, is that right? And you had to jump in a cab to get a flight over to LA for the audition with Guns N' Roses.
I had a car waiting for me. After I think we played three or four nights at Albert Hall, and straight off stage into the car to the airport and flew to LA and got off the plane, went straight to the rehearsal, and then hung out with Axel all night just talking about music, listening to music.
Did you feel that was still part of your audition in many ways? Because I think you were sat in a car, is that right? Listening to music, is that right?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, every gig I've ever done, most of the audition is how you relate to somebody and how you, and when I've auditioned people, I know what, after meeting somebody, I know what they're going to play like. You know, just from their personality.
What songs did you audition?
Boy, it's been a while. I know Riyadh and the Bedouins was one, from Chinese Democracy. Mm. There was a few Chinese songs on there that I auditioned with, as well as, you know, Paradise City, and I don't remember what else was in there.
Obviously, Chinese Democracy was, when you auditioned, was 7 years before it had actually been released. Had you been sent different versions of these songs then prior to kind of learn them, or how did that work?
Sure. Yeah, it was earlier versions.
Wow. And so you had to tell Axel then that you actually couldn't join the band straight away. Is that correct?
I know what you're talking about. He had said, hey, we're going to start rehearsals in 2 weeks. And I said, I can't do it. I'm in the middle of a tour. And he responded and said, you know, that's what he thought about for a second. I could see him sort of like, I could see him thinking, are you kidding me? But then after thinking about it for a second, he said, that's okay, we'll wait for you, because I know that you won't do that to me. You won't leave me stuck, you know? Because really, that's what, in this business, that reputation of being somebody that will jump ship to take another gig is a really bad reputation to have. And, you know, I've agreed to do gigs before for no money, and then had something else come up. And I under no circumstances will I go against that and bail on somebody that I've committed to. So, you know, there's been a few times when I've had to go back to them and say, hey, this came up, I was offered this. And almost every time they are understanding and they say, oh man, we got to do it. You know, don't worry about it. I'll find somebody, you know? But there's been a couple of times when people were like, wow, I was really counting on you. And I have to say, well, then I'll honor it.
Did you have any reservations at all about joining Guns N' Roses? Which I know that sounds like a crazy question because it's a dream gig for a lot of people, I'd imagine. But you know, such a reputation as the band as they were for kind of some crazy lifestyles. You know, the famous stories of Slash. The legend says he died for 8 minutes after a heroin overdose, and you had, you know, Buckethead in the band who for those who don't know was an amazing guitarist who literally put a KFC bucket on his head and performed with a KFC bucket on his head and sunbathed. Actually, believe it or not, I was told as well by someone who was in Rio once. And yeah, so it's pretty crazy lifestyle. Things are pretty mad. Was there any reservations that you had personally?
I'd never heard that about the sunbathing.
But
totally believable. were there any reservations? And did Slash really die for 8 minutes? Is that possible?
Well, that's, yeah, exactly. That's my view a little bit. But
I thought 5 minutes was the max without brain damage.
Yeah, that's, to be honest, that's, I saw that, I had the same view. But there was lots of research I did in this, and all the, I think actually the minutes kept going up and up and up and for every MTV news report at the time. But
I
think you had to have the adrenaline.
That's, I mean, I've never discussed it with him, so.
Well, I think he had the adrenaline shot in his heart, like in Pulp Fiction. I don't know if you know it, but apparently that's what brought him back to life.
Sure.
Yeah. But yeah, so, I mean, it's a crazy lifestyle. Was there anything that you thought, oh, do you know what? This could end badly, or this could not be a good thing?
At that time, no. I mean, there was nothing crazier than what I'd been involved with. And at that time, it was, you know, Tommy was a good friend. I knew Robin, I knew Brain, and I was excited to play with those guys. You know, that it really was sort of a, I mean, at that time, I think if I was going to put together my dream band, it would probably pretty much be that band. You know, Robin's a great talent, and Tommy is an incredible musician and, you know, one of my closest friends. And playing with those guys is sort of a no-brainer for me. And, I, as I'm sure you've read, I wasn't a big Guns N' Roses fan when I joined the band. I just didn't know much about them. I mean, I knew, obviously I knew all the hits, but I didn't own any albums. It wasn't really in my genre, you know. It wasn't where my attention was focused. And I sort of lumped them in with the other L.A. hair bands. And unfortunately, because it's not what they are, and I was, as I started listening to it, I was really excited about it because it's definitely more up my alley than I had originally thought. You know, it's very Stones influenced and very classic rock influenced, as well as being very punk rock influenced, which is that's my background.
Let's talk Axl. he's obviously a great legend. I've done loads of research the last 3 weeks, and my perception from outside is that super charming, really talented guy, very endearing character, cares so much about his music. You said in the past about his integrity, super sensitive character, comes across to me. He's left a lot of gigs, unfortunately, when kind of minor things have gone off. Working with a big personality for the first time, what are the challenges in that situation? Were you aware of any of that stuff? And this answer doesn't necessarily have to be about Axel, but how do you deal as a musician coming in and working with a big personality, with a big reputation? What challenges are there in that situation for someone like yourself or a session musician?
I mean, obviously, I was very aware of his reputation. I mean, I'm from St. Louis, you know, where their biggest riot occurred. In fact, in July, it will be the first time that we actually play St. Louis in 26 years.
Wow.
So I'm really excited about that. But, there's challenges, but I don't know. You sort of have to go into everything weighing that reputation with a grain of salt, because somebody's public persona might have little to nothing to do with reality of who they really are.
Yeah.
And that's just been my experience. And I, anybody that's passionate about music, I've never had a problem getting along with.
Mm. You've obviously got a very close relationship with Axel, because I think you said that he was, you were one of the first people he texted to say that the whole kind of AC/DC thing was going ahead. You've worked with him for many years. I wonder if you could talk us through your memories or your fondest memories of recording Chinese Democracy, an album that had huge kind of hype and expectation. Did you feel any expectation or hype around that? And because I think, did you write the chorus for Better? Is that right?
Yeah. Yes, I did, but no, I don't, it all happened very quickly and organically. Like, I went in and did my parts on the album for the entire album in probably 2 weeks.
Wow.
If that, honestly. You know, I did everything very quickly. All those songs were written for the most part.
Mm.
You know, there were parts that maybe were open, but
and were you
the
recreating?
Axel likes to.
Were you recreating any parts that didn't exist before? Were you? Because I know there was loads of different versions of those songs. So what was your remix in it?
Yeah, I mean, there were some parts that I was just sort of doing my take on that were already written, and there were other parts that. There wasn't anything that I was just, but you know, all there were also two other guitars on there, so I had to find my space, and I don't know. It's just like doing another session in a way, you know, where you're going in, you're listening to things, and just finding your place in it.
It's surely the best mindset to be in, and it sounds like the producer or Axel created that kind of environment which is perfect for that, which is great, because from the outside it always seemed like this big project, Chinese Democracy, most expensive album I think ever produced, lots of different producers, players, songs scrapped, restarted, that kind of thing. It was good that it's good you didn't feel
but,
that pressure.
You know, I think Axel's vocals were probably all done in a very short period of time as well.
Wow.
You know, once he knew what he wanted to do, he went in and did it. And he's an incredible talent. It doesn't really take him that long to do. You know, he'll experiment with – he does a lot of experimenting. When he writes songs, he likes to take pieces and somehow fit them together.
Hmm.
And that's sort of – from my take, that's the genius of Axl Rose. I mean, he – really, and you can go back to the beginning with that, and how he would say, oh, let's put this, why don't we try putting this here? Why don't we try putting that over here? And really just sort of assembled things. And he has a real knack for that.
Tell us about Better. So how was it a case that it was missing a chorus, or did you come prepared with something before?
Yeah. Axel wanted something for a part. You know, he was like, hey, in this section, do you have something that could go in there? And so I just came up with that part.
Was it something that was pre-existing, or did you just come up with it straight away?
No, I think I just came up with it. You know, I played through it a bunch and came up with a part that I liked. And he liked it too. Ideas as well as, but you know, a lot of the stuff that I, when I came in to play on it, he had ideas of what he wanted. You know, just like any producer, it's like that, the feel that you want or the vibe that he was going for.
You sing a lot in harmony with Axel at the live shows that I've seen some coverage of. What's it like singing with Axel? Because I mean, you're a super talented vocalist, like as a solo. I've seen kind of solo gigs of yours or with bands, and you're a really talented singer, and you could do, you know, this thing in your own right, which you do in some cases. What's it like singing with Axel and sharing those vocals? Is that
No, I disagree with you. I don't think I have a great voice at all, and it's sort of a means to an end for me. And really, the majority of the vocals live are Dizzy and Duff. Now, I used to sing a lot more, but most of the vocals are covered by those two guys. The backups are covered by those two guys. And they're both really strong singers. And Melissa as well.
What would a singer or musician working with Axel learn that they wouldn't learn from working with anyone else?
That's a tough one. That they wouldn't learn from anyone else. I mean, like I said, I think the genius of Axel is his ability to assemble songs and make them feel from different parts and make them feel cohesive as a song. And I've never seen anybody be able to do that in the same way.
He's a super talent. And are you recording? I know this is a question you probably get asked every day. Are you recording new stuff at the moment, or is you not allowed to say, or what's the deal with that?
We haven't started recording anything. Well, I mean, when I say that, as far as in a studio doing an album, you know, we've been recording a lot of stuff, just ideas and things, and sort of assembling ideas, but not going into a studio and actually tracking a new record.
Do you think it will happen?
Yeah, I do.
That'd be great. That'd be amazing to hear. Thank you for speaking.
It's sort of too good not to happen at this point. That's how I feel about it. I mean, this band is really it's a force right now, and I definitely hope that we do. And I think we're all sort of counting on it. We're also planning on it.
Can't wait to hear it. That sounds absolutely amazing. So thank you for speaking so honestly about working with Guns N' Roses. Thin Lizzy, a band that you loved, I believed. You played with them as well, because didn't they support Guns N' Roses on a tour? Is that right?
They did after I'd already toured with them.
Oh, so you toured with them before? Right, okay, fantastic. So that must have been...
Yeah, and then when they opened for us, I'd go out and play a couple songs with them.
Nice. How was that? That must have been an incredible experience.
Playing with Scott Gorham is just one of the... And Brian, definitely one of the pinnacle of my career, you know, just because at a very formative age, those records were so important to me. That band was, you know, it doesn't get any better for a guitar player to be able to play those guitar harmonies with Scott, you know. And to play Gary Moore's parts and Robbo's parts, it's just that was a fantastic experience. And I'm really, really happy that I was able to do it, that I was asked to do it, and was able to.
It's lovely to hear you speak about in kind of like there's a real emotion behind playing some of those guitar solos and what that meant to you in your kind of formulaic years listening to that music. Is there ever a case that you kind of go out of the zone when you're playing? Have you ever been kind of almost overwhelmed in a way where you're kind of like, I can't believe this is happening, this is so amazing, this is so amazing, and you're just then relying on muscle memory? Or is it something you just got to constantly focus on?
Oh yeah, it happens all the time. I mean, playing on this tour, when you're playing in front of 100,000 people and you're just standing in a stadium that is packed, it's overwhelming at times. When you're just looking around going, how did this happen? I mean, for me, it's still like, it's amazing. And, you know, I look at Slash and I would be about ready to walk on stage, and it's just like, be looking out, and it's like, I get the same feeling from him and Duff as well. You know, it's like, how really? this is real. I don't know. It still blows me away. But yeah, I mean, standing on stage with Scott, that there'd be times when it was just like, God, I am playing with Scott Gorham. You know, that I don't know. It's still, yeah, of course, it really really gets you.
Fantastic. And I mean, you played a gig in Cuba not so long ago, I believe. Was that a unique new experience? I mean, some bands had played there. I mean, one that gets overlooked is there's a British band, you may or may not have heard of them, called the Manic Street Preachers, and they played there when Fidel Castro was still alive, and he kind of joined them on stage and greeted the crowd and that kind of thing. And I know the Rolling Stones played there, that kind of thing. But yours, I think, was one
Those are English bands. They could have played there at any time.
Yeah. No, I get that. Yeah, that's a fair point. So
it's just nobody plays there because you can't make money playing there.
Yeah.
And so the Stones went in, and after we'd done it, ironically, when the Daisies went, our bass player was Daryl Jones. And
oh wow, yeah.
And Bernard Fowler was singing with us. So a year later, the Stones were doing it. But, you know, we did the same. We sort of set that template where we went in and thought, okay, well, this is an incredible experience. We're going to film and do as much as we can. We put out a book. We filmed the whole thing, made a documentary about it. And that's what they did as well. Not saying they stole our idea. Obviously, they did it a little bigger, but I think definitely that's the way that. And to be honest, I mean, GNR's talked about doing it.
Wow.
You know, because that would be a bigger event because it's such a Guns is such an American band.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
Would be a big deal.
That would be absolutely incredible.
It was a tremendous experience. You know, we recorded at a studio there. We recorded, I think, three songs off of our album, the one of the Dead Daisies albums we recorded in Cuba.
Yeah, get the Guns there, man. That'd be absolutely incredible. That'd be such an iconic. That'd be such an iconic gig. That would be such an iconic gig. Okay, we'll begin to wrap up because I mean, thank you for your time. And we a couple of last questions that we like to ask kind of most of the people we have on here. How do you think you'll evaluate this period of your career when you look back on it in 20 years' time?
Hopefully, it won't be the height. But at the same time, I can't imagine anything being bigger, you know, because it seems like we're setting records everywhere, and it's incredible. It's just the excitement around this has just been overwhelming. You know, I can't imagine topping it, but my career, I've been really fortunate in my career in that it just consistently steps up and up and up, you know, where I haven't really stepped backwards much, you know. So I feel very, very fortunate for that.
What ambitions do you still have left?
I'd like to do an album with this band.
Yeah.
But as far as playing with, what ambitions? I hope to do some, you know, I have not written and played on an album that is legendary, you know, in my opinion. You know, I haven't done an Appetite record, you know. And I hope to do that someday. That would be amazing.
Final question. What fears do you have for the music industry, and how might they be addressed?
There's a lot of fears at the moment. I mean, really, it's an exciting time in that there's been a leveling of the playing field that's exciting because it's given a platform to artists to develop and release music that, you know, had it been 20 years ago, might not have had that opportunity. And some of that stuff is the stuff I find the most inspirational. I don't know. It's a very different landscape. For somebody like me, my career has changed considerably because when I used to not be able to afford to tour because I was making so much as a composer and as a session musician, now it's a totally different thing. Now it's the opposite, you know. The whole industry is different in that way, in that as bands, you know, we don't, where bands used to put out, we used to tour to support records. Now we put out records to support tours.
Mm.
And the days of being able to sit back and collect royalty checks, just this is not happening. You know, you've got to be out playing live because that's where your income comes from now. But, you know, in the same respect, it's exciting because it opens new avenues and there's new challenges. I don't know how to, I mean, those are fears and as well as
opportunities,
solutions. Yeah. Yeah.
So I did say it was going to be the last question. I forgot one question. This is a really generic one, but I think it'd be really useful is, what specific advice would you give A, to a young guitarist, and B, to a musician going into the music industry?
I hate that question.
Ha!
Because it's so different to where I'm at now and to where how I got into the business and why. I think really the only thing you can do as an aspiring young musician is to try and find like-minded musicians to play with and to get recording devices, you know, get your computer set up to be able to make music and to do something really unique. And that's the only way I think you can really get anywhere at this point. And then start, you know, it's the part that I don't know is how to, because what works now, what's going to get the attention of a larger market is not the way it used to be, where, you know, I used to, like I said, my first band, we would put out flyers and we would go play clubs, and you play a club and then the next time you go back, you hope that the audience doubles And when you go to a new city, you play the first time to 5 people, and hopefully there's 10 people the next time. You just keep going back and keep going back. And it's not that way anymore. And people aren't leaving their houses, you know. People aren't going out to support live music as much.
That's very true. And I mean, is there anything you think young musicians might be naive to, that given your experience and where you are in your career, young musicians might be naive to, that you kind of say, look, watch out for that, or anything like that?
It feels like the days of the rock star are over, you know. It's becoming harder and harder. I mean, you have pop stars, but that's a totally different thing. I think all you can do is try and create music that's completely unique and something different. Because whenever you try and jump on a bandwagon, whenever you try and do something like somebody else, it's way too late. You know, doing something completely unique that's not like anybody else out there. You know, I don't listen to much new metal or anything like that. You know, I listen to new rock bands, I guess. But most of the stuff that I listen to is more the indie type of stuff. And, you know, I see so many bands now where I listen to them and I'm thinking, God, that they're exactly like The Cure, or they're exactly like Jesus and Mary Chain, or The Bunning Men, or, like, you know, just on down the line. And of all those, you know, that period of time. And it's just so, it just seems so contrived to me. I mean, I'm much more excited about hearing bands that are doing something really unique. And that's constantly what I'm searching out.
That's a great answer. Thank you. Thank you so much. So I believe you've got, what are the shows you've got in the summer? I know you're playing in London. Are you playing any other kind of, is it a tour for Guns N' Roses coming up?
Yeah, we're playing all over Europe this summer. I think we do May, June, July in Europe. And then we come back to the States. We have 10 days off and we start in St. Louis on July 27th in the States.
That's going to be a big one.
And then we do a lot of the markets that we didn't play here. And a bunch of shows in Canada, and then I think we're going back to South America after that.
Fantastic. I where I'm perched right now, I can pretty much see the Olympic Stadium in London that you are going to be playing a couple of nights in the summer. So yeah, it's going to be amazing this summer. I know you're playing a lot of gigs. Thank you for so much for taking the time to appear. It's testament to your hard work and skill that you've been playing such a great variety of shows with so many amazing musicians for such a long time. You're living the dream. Keep on living the dream, Richard.
Absolutely.
And thanks for being such a great guest on the Stage Left podcast.
Yeah, hit me up this summer and hopefully we can meet up.
I'll give you a shout in the summer if you get to meet up.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks, man. Cheers. Thanks for listening. For more episodes featuring Michael Jackson guitarist Jennifer Batten, Grammy Hall of Fame inductee Steve Cropper, legendary producer Tony Visconti on the recording process of David Bowie's final album Black Star, Sum 41 bassist Cone McCaslin on working with Iggy Pop, and guitarist Billy Burnett on touring with Fleetwood Mac and Bob Dylan, go to thestageleftpodcast.com, follow us on Twitter at @thestageleftpod, like us on Facebook at facebook.com/thestageleftpodcast, subscribe on iTunes to get automatic downloads of new episodes, and follow us on Spotify as well. You can check our Instagram page for more behind-the-scenes material. We'll see you next time.